A podcast of the cinema. Happy 11th anniversary, Dave White.
Yeah.
Of this program.
This podcast is 11 years old.
Mm-hmm. Not so as you'd know it.
It's in middle school.
That's true.
Currently.
It's getting picked on by bullies.
And we are as good at podcasting as any 11-year-old.
Oh, there are probably some 11-year-olds who are better.
I'll beat that kid up. Not afraid. Not afraid of that kid.
If you're 11, you've never not had the internet or access to a laptop. So they're out there, you know, they know how to do the sound files and the TikTok videos and all that stuff.
That's fine.
We do not.
That's fine. It's fine. Your name is Alonzo Duralde.
It is.
You are the co-host of this podcast and the co-host of at least 7 or 9 others. Their names are Maximum Film, Breakfast All Day, and
I'm a recurring.
You're a recurring on Deck the Hallmark.
Yeah.
Okay. With whom you also have a new book.
Yes.
The book is called I'll Be Home for Christmas Movies. It is you co-authoring this book with the Deck the Hallmark gentleman. It is currently available in bookstores from Running Press, a division of Hachette.
Yes.
So it's real and fancy. Understand this. My name is Dave White. I am the co-host of this podcast and 0 other podcasts.
But you are also a film critic.
I'm also a film critic for The Wrap. You were the film reviews editor for The Wrap.
Yes.
Not were, are. You still are. You currently, now and forever.
Well, let's not get crazy.
Are the film reviews editor for The Wrap. And together, we've been sitting at our dining room table, staring lovingly at each other. As lovers do, doing this podcast, talking about the cinema.
Yes.
Somebody sent us a Ralph Lauren holiday candle with no note at all.
And I have a vague recollection of somebody messaging me about this.
Oh.
But I cannot find that message. In the emails, on the socials, so it is a mystery.
Whoever you are, and if you did indeed message Alonzo about it beforehand, asking for an address or whatever, and he let it slip through the sieve
that is my mind.
Of his mind, for that he apologizes. We would like to know who you are, mystery person.
Yes.
Because, thank you, those are not cheap candles.
No. Thank you is very much in order.
Alonzo is obsessed with the Ralph Lauren holiday candle. He requires one each year.
It smells like Christmas.
It smells really good.
I didn't make the rules.
It does smell really good. It is one of the few, like one of a handful of like Christmas, you know, adjacent candles.
Yes.
That I can deal with. And he got the All Things Cozy podcast seal of approval. I know that.
Oh, for sure.
Because one of us was on.
Yeah, I took it with me.
Oh, it was, you took that with you?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I knew one of us was on and brought a candle. I think I might have brought a candle with me too for candle review.
Well, yeah, I think we always do, but I brought the holiday one.
I can't remember what I brought. I have no memory of which one I brought.
Come de Garçon, perhaps?
It might have been one of the Come de Garçon candles because those are weird and they are also my favorites.
Yes.
And they also cost as much as the Ralph Lauren holiday candle.
Well, I'll tell you, holiday candles in general is my type of candle.
Yeah.
Because it's where you're getting into the cloves and the pine trees, your, you know, oranges. These are all smells that I'm down for.
Yeah.
So generally speaking, I think, you know, part of my Christmas obsession is that this time of year is the best time of year for candles and hand soaps.
Right.
Right. Now,
it's the only time of year when
with your gingerbread and your vanilla cookie.
No, thank you.
And that stuff. No.
I do not enjoy the candle that smells like baked treats.
Yes.
Because they never get that smell right. It's always a chemical version of that smell.
Of course.
I don't like it. I've never liked it.
But like there can be peppermint. There are some okay ones.
You really got to do it right. Mm. Honestly, you know. And I'll tell you, with a candle, you kind of get what you pay for. This is the one time of year that we indulge in the fancy candle.
Yes.
Because, you know, daylight saving time has ended. We're back on standard time. It gets darker earlier. You want a candle going. The windows tend to be closed. So you want that lovely, like, fragrance.
Cozy home fragrance.
You want that cozy home fragrance. And so it is at this time of year that we will like say, you know what? Yes, that candle is expensive. Yes, also we are going to buy it.
the rest of the year it's back to Target, but for now.
As I like to say about our addiction to Christmas ornament purchases, you know, some people get tattoos.
Or travel.
They travel to faraway places. Yes. We buy fancy candles sometimes and Christmas tree ornaments. That's right. We have some news.
Oh?
It's news about us.
Oh.
An important breaking news development about us. We are going back to theaters.
Yes.
In a limited way, when no one else is there.
Ideally.
And
we're going back to as empty a theater as we can get our hands.
You are even going to a press screening tomorrow.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I am.
And it became a thing where, you know, during the year 2020, all the publicity folks representing all the films, big and small.
Yeah.
You know.
Which were still happening.
Wonder Woman and even like the teeny tiny
films. Yeah.
Okay. They were sending every thing to film critics via streaming links to help us do our jobs.
Yes.
And I would say starting around June, July of this year, just before the Delta variant made everything stupid again,
mm-hmm.
they started becoming very ungenerous with those links.
Yeah, and at first it wasn't a problem because, you know, by the middle of May, that's, you know, I remember that was the day that I saw A Quiet Place 2 and F9. It was like, I'm vaccinated, and we're wearing masks. There's seats between us, so we're going to do this.
Right. And then come the Delta variant, and you and I both said, hey, we're going back inside of our apartment.
Yes, until further notice.
But the publicists didn't care about people like us.
For the most part.
I would say for the most part. Some did, some have been helpful.
Yes.
Most have not been helpful.
Also, yes.
It's not necessarily in the hands of the individual publicist.
Sure.
They are just the people who have to implement the decision that came from above them. So we don't blame any of them.
No.
Personally. We love you all if you're listening. I think only one is listening, maybe two. But our job became much more difficult.
Yes,
to do. But now we've had our third shots, and you have traveled to Greenville, South Carolina, to mm-hmm. help promote the book.
Yep.
We have been outside the apartment to do things, and the numbers of the cases in Los Angeles have gone down, 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 down. It feels okay again.
We have our at-home tests.
We're not running around willy-nilly.
No.
But we're going to start catching up on the films that we have missed.
Yes.
You know, we used to be, before I'd say the beginning of this year, we were on top of what was coming out.
Yeah, on a week-to-week basis.
And for the past 2-3 months now, we've been not on top of what's been coming out. We've just been, you know, seeing what we can see and talking about that.
Well, I think between now and the end of the year, what we're going to see is that you know, I'm going back to press screenings. You and I are going to start going to like weekday matinees.
I will also attend press screenings with you.
Okay.
Depending on
sure
how necessary it feels.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
But then also, it's the time of year ostensibly when awards links or DVDs
maybe.
Will show up. Maybe.
We assume. It has been historically the case that that does happen.
Yes.
But you know what? If the past couple of years have taught us
anything,
it's that you cannot look to tradition to figure out what is about to come around the corner. So, to that end, you, not me, went to see Spencer.
I did.
I will see it soon.
Yes.
But you went and I could not go. What year does this take place?
They never say specifically, but it's basically it's the end of their marriage.
Okay.
It is, you know, like Camilla is around and
it all takes place over the course of like one Christmas holiday.
Yeah, like 2 or 3 days.
Like in Balmoral, is that where they were?
One of the houses.
This is a movie about Princess Diana.
Yes.
And her decision. Well, you tell me what it's about.
Okay.
Because all I know is that Kristen Stewart is in it, which means totally going to see it.
Yes.
I don't even know if there's there's not, because if it only takes place over the course of a few days, the revenge dress does not make an appearance.
I don't think so.
You know what I'm talking about.
I've been seeing headlines about the revenge dress. I don't quite know which dress is revenge dress.
It's a very important dress.
There are some great outfits in this movie. And very 80s outfits.
Yes.
Yeah, so basically it's Kristen Stewart, directed by Pablo Lorraine, who did Jackie and who did No, and a lot of people tend to forget that he had a film career before Jackie, but he had one.
Yes.
Anyway, so the film traffics in a lot of metaphors, because at the beginning of the film, she is literally lost.
Oh, wow. Okay.
She's driving herself up to whatever manor, Downton Abbey thing this is. And can't seem to find it, even though...
You think they would slum at a place like that?
No, I know. You know what I mean.
Come on, man.
Like 10 Downton Abbeys fused together.
Right.
It is not far from the house where she grew up.
Yeah.
And of course, once again, metaphor alert, she keeps trying to get into that house.
Right.
While she's there. She is dealing with an eating disorder. She is a loving mother to William and Harry, who have a great relationship with her, clearly. Charles and Elizabeth, not so much. And she is feeling sort of constantly...
You didn't have to wait for Oprah to try to dig it out of Harry.
No. Yeah, I was right there.
It's always been right there. Yeah.
So she's feeling a lot of pressure. Like, you know, there's all these outfits and then it's laid out like when she's supposed to wear each one. And oh no, she wore, you know, Boxing Day lunch to Christmas morning church, blah, 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 you know.
Okay.
And, you know, Timothy Spall plays this sort of ex-military guy who's sort of running security and making sure the Paps don't get too close. But he's also sort of like leaning on Diana to behave herself and do all the things that she's expected to do.
Right.
This is the kind of movie where the word fun is weaponized.
Right.
It's like everything they're doing for the Christmas stuff. Oh, it's fun. It's traditional. It's fun. And somebody described it as a Christmas horror movie, which it basically is.
Yeah.
It is, you know, it's very much this sense of paranoia. She doesn't know who she can trust. There's a dresser who she's kind of close to, played by Sally Hawkins.
Yeah.
But like then she gets sent away because she's close to Diana, you know.
Right.
And they try and say, oh, well, you know, she's told everybody you're cracking up. And like, just, Diana doesn't know who to trust.
Right.
So it's this very sort of internalized just POV of this woman going through this awful period. There's a book about Anne Boleyn in her room,
who
of course was, you know, beheaded because the king loved somebody else. So she's feeling that whole pressure and stuff. And it's this very sort of internalized kind of psychological portrait of a woman over the course of a couple of days dealing with the literal eyes of the world being upon her, and also this, like, you know, this awful, awful family that she's trapped in and trying to deal with. you know, the firm, as we now know. So, yeah, I thought it was great. Johnny Greenwood does the score, which definitely ratchets up the tension.
Right.
And Kristen Stewart, she does the thing that I always talk about when we talk about biopics, and we'll talk about this later in the episode when we get to Respect. She does disappear. I didn't feel like I was always watching Kristen Stewart doing somebody else. She captures a Diana-ness that I bought into and that really works in the film. And you just feel so much for her and you wish that like somebody was there to save her from all this.
Yeah.
And you know, I was mezzo on Jackie, but that's a thing where a woman is giving you flashbacks and you can sort of watch her creating the mythos of Camelot, you know, as she's making it up basically. But this is very direct and in the moment, you know, where her life is headed and all of the terrible things that are coming up in the future. But you sense that, you know, she's just already in the thick of the worst of it.
Yeah.
And you know, it's filmed in that way of, we always talk, you having lived in England for a while, make the joke.
No, I didn't live in England for a while.
For 6 months.
I was at school for a semester.
Okay.
It's not the same thing.
That's longer than I've ever lived in England.
Okay.
But you always talk about how British movies tend to be really sunny. And it's like, where did that come from?
Frequently, yeah, unless they're, you know, Mike Lee films or whatever.
But this is a movie that it is very wintry and overcast and, you know. So, yeah, I dug it.
I'm very excited to see it.
I think you'll like it.
Yeah. With or without a revenge dress. Perhaps I'll wear my own revenge dress when I watch it.
Oh, please. No, she wears these, you know, some of these great, like, those 80s kind of woolly Chanel jackets.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, and yeah, it's
AKA great. A Chanel jacket of any era.
But you know that there's a certain color story going on in the 80s that you don't get in other eras of Chanel.
Okay, well, thank you for that review, Alonso.
You're welcome.
Moving on. The Harder They Fall.
Yes.
This is the feature debut from James Samuel, who is a musician. He's British. He's also known as The Bullets, which is his, you know, performing name as a musician. He's done a couple shorts, one with Jay-Z, and Jay-Z is a producer on this film. Like, his credit is Sean Carter, but, you know, and it is a Western, and it is a heavily stylized Western about revenge.
Yes.
It's about a man named Nat Love. And he wants revenge on Rufus Buck. Why?
Okay, so Rufus Buck was one of a group of bad, bad men who murdered Nat Love's parents in front of him and scarred his forehead with a razor blade. And Nat has spent his life as an outlaw, basically killing off every person involved with that. And he didn't kill Rufus because Rufus was in jail and was supposed to be in jail forever. But Rufus has gotten a pardon. So Nat has to saddle up once again, get his old team of outlaws back together, including his ex-stagecoach Mary, who is seemingly retired and is now running a saloon. Played by Zazie Bates, I just found out is how you say her name.
I've been calling her Zazie Beats.
I have too, but it turns out she's like German or something, and it's Zazie Bates.
Zazie Bates.
Yes.
Well, it's a cool name regardless.
It is.
Nat Love is played by Jonathan Majors.
Yes, he is.
Rufus Buck is played by Idris Elba.
Yes, I was getting there.
Okay.
I got
there to before you in a very helpful way.
So we have two gangs about to clash. You have Nat's gang, and then you've also got Rufus's, which includes Regina King and Lakeith Stanfield.
Yeah.
And so obviously things are going to come to a bloody head. This is a Western that loves Westerns. This mm-hmm. is a Western that is made by somebody who clearly loves the elements and the pieces of this kind of filmmaking for audiences who do as well. And it's, you know, you can pick out, oh, that's the John Ford and that's the Sergio Leone or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it's not an empty pastiche. It is vibrant and alive and... you know, this is a kinetic piece of film, even if it is clearly, you know, there's homage going on here, but there is the genuine excitement of Westerns done well.
Yeah, it's got all the, you know, the things you expect when you expect a Western.
Yeah.
You know, gunfights and horses and bank robberies and train robberies and, you know, hand-to-hand combat, and it's very violent.
Very.
And
what it also has that the American West had, but the American Western does not so much, is black people.
Yes.
We know historically that a great many of the cowboys in that period were black.
Yeah.
But classic Westerns have been very, very white.
Well, classic American film has been very, very white.
Also,
and that is, you know, a historical wrong. Yes. That is slowly being corrected.
And as, you know, a Westerns expert that we had on Max Film pointed out, even this film, you know, doesn't include the many Chinese and Latino and indigenous people that also populated the West of that period. But it is great to see this many black characters front and center, you know, whose story it is. And in fact, the film even tells you at the beginning that even though none of this actually happened, all of these people are real. These are all genuine characters from the West.
Yeah.
And yeah, so it's...
The real life people didn't do any of the stuff that you're seeing in this film.
No, of course not. And so, you know, yeah, there is a, you know, I think... I don't want to say there's a music video energy to this kind of movie because that suggests a certain kind of editing or a certain kind of...
Right.
I mean, there are some great music choices being implemented, and there are even a couple of musical numbers in this movie, which is kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
But he is not afraid of a long take.
Yeah.
Particularly in the climactic hand-to-hand scene between Bates and King, which is really exciting to watch because... For me, one of the big disappointments in recent years, both in action movies and in musicals, is that they haven't taken the time to rehearse the choreography. And so they cover that up by cutting a lot. And
right.
In this one, you get these long, fluid motion, a full range of action that occurs between two people, whether it be the actresses or their stunt doubles. And I was really thrilled by it.
I agree with everything you are saying.
Great. You should more often.
We are in one accord on this film. I really, here's what I like about it. A lot of the things that you just said, but I'm going to repeat them. It is really talky. I'm very into that. This dialogue that is clearly scripted. Like, they're not going for a realist sort of, you know, conversational pattern between people.
They're certainly not going for the, like, you know, man with no name, terse silences.
No. It's, but like, this is dialogue that is clearly scripted to be of a sort of uniform type, you know, like the way in old, like, old Lubitsch films where everyone is just sort of like rat-a-tat-tat in the same way.
Sure.
But you still get their character, you know? So it feels like you're in a world where everyone is sort of on board for, we're talking now,
yes.
You know, but it's, again, that dialogue is delivered, effortlessly by this cast to make it all seem like it comes from their individual characters. What I'm digging about, James as a director is this is his first feature.
Yeah.
And it feels like he has arrived fully formed, you know, perhaps in debt to a lot of other films and filmmakers, but ready also to put his stamp on it. And like you said, it's not just a pastiche. I mean, it is There are elements of that. I mean, it is a pastiche, but it's a very clever one. It's a classic template spun his way. And you were mentioning the musical cues that are anachronistic, but they are also appropriate, and they aren't merely a chance for him to show off his good taste in right. song choices. So there's a lot going on here. There's lots of characters, there's lots of action. I'm disappointed in the extremely limited theatrical presence that this is getting. Like, in Los Angeles, I looked this up.
Right.
One theater.
Yeah.
Once a day.
Well, it's a Netflix movie.
And that theater is in the Palisades. So, oh, like, man. You have to commit
right.
to driving out there to, like, rich people town.
Unless you live in rich people
town. In a far-flung part of the city, you know.
Yeah, this is...
That bothers me, because I wish there was a way... Like, this should be on the screen at the Chinese.
Yeah.
It's that big. There's, you know, formally speaking, he is really making use of lots of space
yeah.
in a major way. And at the same time, pouring on all of this detail that wants to be looked at.
It's shot by the guy who shot The Master.
That's... Yes,
for PTA. So yeah, and this is definitely a movie I would want to see again projected at some point.
The PTA, Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah. Drea on Max Film was saying that just as a producer, she was constantly clocking at how much money they obviously had
mm-hmm.
because of just the art direction and the train and the, you know, just even to the idea of
the paint job on that town.
Yes, absolutely.
and then the paint job on that other town.
Yes. But also like just the shadows of when like gunfighters are facing off.
Yeah.
Like that's the kind of thing you have to wait all day for, you know, and this movie has a lot of that. And it's just,
right.
it's very precise in the way that it's visual presentation. Also, Jonathan Majors and Zazie Beetz have insane sexual chemistry.
Yeah, they are lovers in this film in a way that American film has stopped for the most part, unless you're in the world of indie film, and even then it's not the same thing because in indie film, romance is troubled,
sure.
generally,
yeah.
sex is troubled, you know, and here you've got a very old-fashioned approach to these people are into each other in a major way, and we're going to take time to let you see that
right.
and let them grow into that the way, you know, classic American film used to do. We've abandoned that. And I think it's because the 70s were so wild that actors themselves are like, what do I want out of this project in relation to my body, particularly if I'm in love with a character on screen? How will that be expressed? There's been so much exploitation that it feels like we're in this pendulum swing of everyone is, was an article about the Marvel films? Everyone is beautiful and no one is having sex?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Which I think The Eternals is trying to maybe turn that ship around. Yeah. We haven't seen it yet. But yeah, and I think obviously you can point to certain films like, you know, Henry and June, say, as being right. like, well, obviously American audiences are terrified of sex and they don't want to see it in movies. They'd
the
rather watch it.
The Photograph is a good example of a film that really makes use of,
yes.
You know, love and relationship and romance
yeah.
in the way that you wish you could watch that sort of, you know, on-screen chemistry between characters.
Yeah. Movies aren't swoony enough these
yeah.
days. I mean, and lest we be accused of overselling this film, it could lose 15 minutes. It is...
It's pretty long.
Yeah.
It's like 2 hours and 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think as a directorial debut, this is very exciting. And... And Westerns are not the top of my list of favorite genre, but I do really enjoy this one. And yeah. and I think that it's a good middle ground for people who love Westerns seem to be into it. And then people who could go either way on Westerns, there's enough there, you know, to sort of bring them into the fold.
It is also, I think, very serious about being a corrective to the all-white
Western.
Absolutely.
But not quite so serious about everything else, other than when it becomes serious about its story. You know, it doesn't ignore the sort of structural genocidal trouble of black life in the 19th century.
Right,
here.
But it doesn't center it either.
Yeah, so exactly. And what it does, yes, is make this fictional world where black characters can focus on something other than survival.
Right. And as our guest on Max Film pointed out, the idea of the government encroaching upon personal liberties is kind of a theme of Westerns anyway.
Yeah.
Who, no matter who the characters are, you know, there's this notion of like the wildness and the freedom versus the, you know, the eventual like governmentalization of this territory.
It's time for a podcasty audio commercial.
Yes.
For RogerandChris.com.
Yes.
Play the jingle. It's y'all. Okay. Before you play it.
Yeah. So we need to explain the jingle.
Thank you, David and Johanna.
Yes.
For composing a jingle. I sent it to Chris and I said, hey, do you want us to play this on the show? He goes, this is the easiest marketing I've ever done. He said, yes, please go ahead, do it.
Fine furniture, if it's your life, at RogerandChris.com.
Yay.
Fine furniture that fits your life
at RogerandChris.com.
I was just thinking about this. Now, obviously, you know, I need
if
to
this
keep.
Were, if this were a real podcast, I could have laid that music right into it.
Instead of just holding,
out
your,
of my phone,
holding your phone
into
up
microphone,
to the yeah.
This is what you get after 11 years.
This doesn't mean I'm going to stop writing my own jingle.
Okay.
This is like the competing Truman Capote films now. Because I, you know, they make a couch you'll want to kiss, I think is one of the great lyrics. I'm like, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein. All in one right now.
It'll so keep your butt off the floor.
We, David and Johanna, we're in a contest now, and I will be further.
You will be the prize winner of
composing lyrics. Yes, I am the prize winner of Defiance, Ohio.
RogerandChris.com.
I was thinking about our chair.
Yes.
The other day, because I think about our chair every day. Yesterday I was putting away laundry,
mm-hmm.
and all the laundry is currently in the chair.
Yes.
You know, just we wash clothes, we dry the clothes, and then we don't immediately fold it and put it away. We throw it in the chair, and the chair is very big, and it takes a lot of unfolded laundry to fill it up. But then here comes the dilemma. Each day, I want to sit in the chair and read some. But if there's laundry in the chair,
you have to move the laundry to the bed.
I can't. And so what this chair does, and the reason our chair from RogerandChris.com is so good, is it makes me fold the laundry faster than I otherwise would.
So you can get to the treat so that is the chair.
Yes, so I can dig through.
So the laundry is the stick and the chair is the carrot.
Yes. It's piled high with socks and t-shirts and towels and underpants. And I will wade through those underpants to get to the chair.
There's a slogan.
They make them in all the sizes, the depths, the heights, the colors, the legs, the arms, the backs, the fronts.
You can customize
the
it.
The depths.
All the way you want.
It. It's so much customization, and it's all done by you.
And built in the United States.
Yes. RogerandChris.com.
RogerandChris.com.
The end of the ad. Let's talk about Finch.
Sure.
All right, so Tom Hanks is a, what kind of engineer is he?
Mechanical, I think it's safe to
say. He's some kind of engineer who knows how to make things happen and yes. with computers, and he builds robots, and he can make AI, and
yeah,
it's the future. So he's, you know, he's just, he can do that as a hobby, but it was also his job.
Right.
But then a big gamma ray.
Gamma flares, apparently. Like knocked out most of the ozone layer.
A space force of some kind.
Yes. Nothing that was our fault. Heaven knows.
It just happened.
An external threat.
It was like a meteor, asteroid kind of situation. Yes. But whatever a gamma flare is, they are real. Smart people. Would anyone like to explain to us?
What is gamma flare?
What it may, what that is. Anyway, it happens to the planet. The entire globe turns into a nuclear radiation hot zone.
Dust bowl.
And most everybody dies except for those some people who have survived. And those people who have survived are killing each other for what's left of the food. Because once the food runs out, that's it.
Yeah.
Can't grow nothing. Nothing is happening except if you didn't die in a merciful way, you get to stick around and slowly die of either starving or radiation poisoning. Tom Hanks has an RV and a kind of a sweet hookup. Like he's in a bunker that he has figured out how to create electricity for, and he's got, you know, nice AC. It's like 150 degrees outside.
Yeah.
And he's got a suit that he can walk around outside in and it cools him.
He worked for a utility company.
He's got a robot, a little R2-D2 kind of robot that goes beep, boop, bop, you know. But he's building another one that is AI that will talk to him and learn.
Yes. And he has a dog. And
dog somehow not dying of radiation poisoning, although we've never...
I don't think the dog leaves the bunker. I think the dog's been down there for a very long time.
The dog is outside with him later in the film.
Well, I don't know how much radiation there is, apart from just...
I thought that was the case.
No, I think it's just that the sun doesn't have the ozone layer, so it's scorching the planet.
Oh, okay. Sure. Don't at me about details on this movie, because it's not worth anyone's time.
Yeah, so anyway, big storm is coming. They have to leave, and they decide to head towards San Francisco. Tom Hanks, big, tall robot, who is voiced and mo-capped by Caleb Landry Jones.
Yep.
And the dog in the RV, and of course, you know, the robot has to learn to be human.
Right.
This movie feels like pieces of other movies that you've seen already. Even some movies starring Tom Hanks. this is kind of like Castaway.
Right.
Instead of talking to a volleyball, he has a robot.
Yeah.
And, you know, it... as much as I hated the movie Tomorrowland, it had a really good point about the fact that, like, at some point we stopped looking forward to the future, and all we make are these post-apocalyptic, you know, end-of-the-world doomsday scenarios.
Right.
And I'm a little sick of them at this point.
I agree.
And I think after the last 2 years especially... Even if it flies in the face of all logic, and even if it flies in the face of the fact that the giant corporations and politicians in charge of things don't seem to care about the fact that we are making this planet uninhabitable for our own species.
Yeah.
The whole point of art, not the whole point of art, but a point of art is to, you know, visualize something else, something better, something truer, something more, you know... hopeful. And so I would love to start seeing some movies that maybe like don't assume that within 50 years this will be nothing but a big ball of wind and dust. That said, not to put all the burden of that onto Finch, give me something new, because I feel like I've seen this apocalypse before. I feel like I've seen this relationship before. And I just never really... I mean, like, there's... Tom Hanks gets a couple of really good monologues at the end of the movie, and Tom Hanks is Tom Hanks. Of course, you are invested in the character. And even the robot gets a pretty good monologue toward the end.
Yep.
But yeah, overall, I just was kind of... Bleh.
The doggy.
Oh, Seamus. I looked up his name because he's a star.
That's his actual real-life dog name, yes. Seamus.
Sure.
Well, he is, for me, anyway, he's the new Uggy. Because I've rarely seen a dog with as naturally expressive a face as this one in recent film.
Mind you, the director relies upon him a lot with the like cute doggy reaction shots.
Why not? Like,
but he gives them,
and you care about his well-being. You also care about Tom Hanks, because who other than the QAnon freaks don't like Tom Hanks? Who doesn't like Tom Hanks besides those dummies? Like, even when the film is not great. Was that submarine movie last year? That was not exactly great.
It wasn't a submarine, but Greyhound.
Greyhound, sorry, not a submarine movie, but a warship movie. I sat through that whole thing thinking, sure do like Tom Hanks.
Yeah. Tom Hanks is entering his fifth decade of Tom Hanksing, and he does it very well.
So that kept me going through this, just enjoying watching, you know, America's late middle-aged dad on the big screen, or rather the TV screen.
Yes, it's on Apple TV.
It's on Apple TV Plus. Is it in theaters as well, or
maybe?
But yeah, otherwise there's not a lot going on here, and I do want to put more blame on this film for the thing you were complaining about, because it's something we discussed while we were watching it. We have so many films about doomsday and what happens after. It has become sort of the dominant view of looking at the future.
Yeah. And unless you're going to be Mad Max Fury Road.
Right. It has become the dominant way of looking at the future in kind of global media, not just American media. Like, it's either the zombie apocalypse, or the nuclear apocalypse, or the climate apocalypse, or the, you know, the electric surge, or the gamma flare, or
the Hunger Games.
The Hunger Games, yeah. The future is a desperate, dire horror show. And I will, I think, go so far as to say that TV, film, have a responsibility. I think I'll go so far as to say it is a moral responsibility to, if we're gonna create a mood in the population, what would happen if the mood they tried to create was, well, here's a movie about an impending apocalypse, and people work together to make it not happen.
Yeah.
They don't work together to survive. They work together to make it not happen. You know, take a big dump all over Michael Bay if you want. But Armageddon was about preventing the end of the world.
Sure. Look, The Martian. The Martian is a riveting movie about problem solving and you know, like, using what we know to fend off certain disaster.
Where is the big budget all-star film about fixing climate change?
Yeah.
Through legislation. That's what I want to see. I already know that in the post-apocalyptic death future of too much sun and heat, I'm just going to wither and die in a ball while crying.
Oh, like, yeah, no, we're part of the first wave of casualties, no question.
I'm going to be 60 years old in 3 years. I would go. It would be, it wouldn't have been enough life.
Yes. We're not.
But it would have been a wonderful life.
We are not wearing pelts and scavenging.
Well, now wait. I'd look pretty sexy in a pelt, I think.
Sure, but...
Yep, come on now.
Look, you and I are both too delicate for the post-apocalypse. Let's just be honest.
Yeah, once the pantry's empty...
Yeah.
We would just, like, go outside and let the Warriors just sort of, you know, baseball bat us to death.
Basically, yeah. We're out of candles. There's no point.
Yeah, there's no more potato chips. in the pantry and have all the books, I guess. Have the books. We've got a lot of books in there. Yeah, they're all yours. this movie is not that great. No, and I'm not super into it. You know what else is not that great?
What?
Speaking of catching up on films that we've been needing to catch up on.
Ah, yes.
A film that was released in August mm-hmm. to theaters only, but it is now finally streaming and on DVD and Blu-ray. Respect.
Mm.
The biopic of Aretha Franklin, starring Jennifer Hudson.
And it is the biopickiest biopic that ever biopicked.
It takes you roughly through a 20-year span.
Yeah.
From her young childhood, where she is learning that she is gifted, to the Amazing Grace
documentary
concert. It is a feature from South African director Liesel Tommy. This is, I think, her first theatrical.
Yes, she's done a lot of TV.
She's done lots of TV. And it is, as you said, it follows the biopic template kind of to the letter.
Yeah.
And it somehow manages to take thrilling subject matter. A woman who changed musical history in the United States permanently. A woman whose musical presence in the world was, like, without flaw. Like, one of the great vocalists of the 20th century.
Yes.
It's like Maria Callas, Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald,
Judy Garland,
Whitney Houston, Aretha Franklin. I've probably left out a couple others, but
Edith Piaf.
You can count them on two hands, right? The towering greats.
Yeah.
The minute she gets out of young childhood without a moment in the film that raises the hair on the back of your neck in terms of how vocally gifted she was,
mm-hmm.
I started to think, oh no, this is a 2.5-hour film about an incredibly exciting person, and it's not going to be exciting.
Yeah.
And it's not.
It is not exciting.
And
it is 2.5 hours.
None of this, I need to say, none of this is Jennifer Hudson's fault.
That's fair.
Because what Jennifer Hudson can do is what she did in Dreamgirls. She brings a warmth and an openness to her time on screen. Even when she's in a project where she's not singing,
mm-hmm.
you see her and you feel like she's your friend. You love Jennifer Hudson.
Yes.
And that is something that you want, you know, in a portrayal of Aretha Franklin. And apparently Aretha Franklin herself said, I want you to play me.
That's my understanding. Yes.
Yeah. She also, thankfully, is not doing an Aretha Franklin impersonation.
No.
She can't. Nobody could. If you tried to do an Aretha Franklin impersonation, no matter how good a singer you are, and Jennifer Hudson is really wonderful.
Yes.
As a singer. You couldn't approximate what Aretha Franklin could do. Because it was too idiosyncratic and too personal and too nuanced to mimic
yes.
in a way that would make people feel like you had disappeared. You were talking about how Kristen Stewart disappears into Princess Diana.
Right.
Jennifer Hudson never disappears. you are always aware that you are watching a person standing in for Aretha Franklin.
Right.
Singing these songs that Aretha Franklin sang, singing them really well.
But singing them the way Jennifer Hudson
Jennifer Hudson would sing them. And that's not the same thing.
Yeah.
So that isn't actually to the film's detriment.
No, that's not the problem.
Because her performances of these songs are great.
Yeah.
You like watching Jennifer Hudson sing Aretha Franklin songs. It is the pacing, it is the directing, it is the writing, it is the that desperate need always on the part of biopics to, we have to pack in all these story beats, all these things that really happened, you know, and yet we also have to stop at them and explore them for a moment and make everything grind to a halt for a while. And then we'll let her sing to pick it back up again.
To its credit, the movie does tackle like the tougher stuff. You know, the fact that, you know, there was abuse and how that impacted her, and she like didn't speak for a very long time after that. Like, we get that. Another thing the movie does well, I think, is it's hard for, especially in biopics like this, or in movies about songwriters or whatever, to show the creation of a song as you know it.
Yes.
And not have it be that, like, that terrible part in Crossroads where Britney is writing Not a Girl, Not Yet a Woman.
Right.
You get a couple of those in this movie. The way that she does, The Way That I Love You.
I Never Loved a Man.
I Never Loved
the
a Man.
Way I Love You.
And then the way that she turns Otis Redding's respect into her respect. Both of those sequences, like, oh, okay, the process is really fascinating. And it's far more interesting than anything about her actual life that you get in this movie.
Yeah, the biographical details are what I was talking about when I said they sort of, everything kind of grinds to a halt.
Yeah.
And I thank you for bringing that up, because that's where I was wanting to, it's in my notes.
Oh, okay.
I wanted to make sure that to say that there are elements of this film that are really wonderful to watch. And it is those in the studio moments where the movie makes extra sure to remind you that she was a musician.
Yes.
Who knew exactly what she wanted. And she had the song in her head the way she wanted it to be presented. And she fought for her way and got her way, because you didn't get in her way. Once she came into her power as a musician and singer, there was no stopping her. Right. She was there in the studio with all those musicians saying, no, not this, this. No, you don't do that. You follow me, and I'll let you know how I need this to go. That was really nice, because Aretha Franklin is so legendary, and because she belongs historically now to the world. What happens with towering figures like that is the idiosyncratic details of their life often will get sanded down, erased, forgotten. You want to, the oldies stations are just like, here's Aretha Franklin and she sings Respect. And a film like this that does go deeper into the
mechanics
of making a song, that is one reason why it's worthwhile.
Yeah, and I think generally female vocalists don't get the credit they deserve.
Right.
Like, you know, you think of like Sinatra or Bing Crosby, like those are the guys in charge, and they come in and they tell everybody what to do.
Right.
And I think there's this notion sometimes with women, it's like, oh, you know, you put them in a recording studio and they sing and they're so... they're so talented and that's it. And yeah, it is that she's a producer, essentially.
Yeah.
She understands the mechanics and the process by which all of this works, and the movie gives her that due.
Yeah.
That respect, if you will.
The other thing that I will credit this film for is not ignoring her political beliefs.
Yes.
Because in the late 60s and early 1970s, there is one sequence where she's talking about Angela Davis and the Black Panthers and the police and being very forceful.
Yeah.
And it's not something that her mainstream legacy often likes to include or remember. But she really was part of that movement in a powerful way. They start the film, she's young, and she's singing a lot, touring around with Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
And I thought, as they showed that, I thought, are they also going to show her after his death? And the more, I hate to use the word radical, because it's not radical. It's appropriate and real.
Right. But they were self-described radicals.
Activism, yeah. But you know how people react to the word
radical. Of course. No, for sure.
So it does include that. So it's a mixed bag. Overall, this is not a great film.
No.
But it is, as you said, it's quite long.
But it's got some things going.
And it doesn't thrill you the way you want to be thrilled by Aretha Franklin. I will never forget, and it's on YouTube somewhere, I can't find it, but it's on YouTube somewhere, Don Cornelius on Soul Train saying, "You are lucky to be alive in a time when this woman is singing." Here she is, performing live on Soul Train, Aretha Franklin.
Yeah, certainly there's nothing in this movie that raised the hairs on my neck the way that the actual Amazing Grace documentary did.
Yeah. So, if you super love Aretha Franklin, and you are curious about this, sure, watch it. It has its moments.
Yeah.
I just wish there were more of them, and I wish that it had made me feel, again, as excited as I feel when I hear her. And every time I hear her, my entire life, it has been exciting.
Yeah.
If I watch a YouTube clip of her, I wind up in a rabbit hole for 45 minutes watching other YouTube clips of her. So, respect. Respect to respect, I guess.
I guess. We have a breaking news bulletin.
You don't know this because everything is so smooth and like glass.
No one can
here.
Tell.
We took a break for a moment to tend to some stuff. And in the middle of that break, I got a message from Kaiser Permanente that since my 10 weeks ago diagnosis of type 2 diabetes at a 7.8 A1C, I have dropped down to 6.8, which means I am now merely
pre-diabetic. A full point.
I have to keep going down into the 5 range so that I'm not at all in any kind of danger for this. But
I'm so proud of you.
Yeah.
You've been doing the exercising. You've been following all the dietary things. I'm so proud of you because I could never pull that off.
You know what? It's like every day when I eat a meal and I'm not full at the end of it, I just have to talk to myself in my brain and say, "You're done eating and you are not full. And if you don't like it, Dave White, you can go F yourself." And I have.
All right. We got to wrap up. We have some amazing letters from y'all. Thank you for anybody who sent them in to linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We will get to them next time. I have an actual press screening.
Yeah, you got a press screening you have to get off to.
It's been a while.
Have we gone an hour?
Yeah.
Okay, we're at an hour. All right, I'm sorry. Yeah. So yeah, we have the letters. We're going to push them to the next episode. And thank you for waiting for this one. The delay was a bizarre, mysterious technical situation.
Yeah, I don't even know what
happened. Pushed a wrong button and half the show got deleted and we had to come back in and do it
again. Yeah, something weird like that. Anyway.
It's all been a whirlwind in this home.
For sure. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Check out our friends in the on the podcast universe. Hey, I'm on the new episode of All Things Cozy with Bran from Deck the Hallmark, and we have a lovely chat about Hallmark movies and Christmas and stuff in general. And of course, we talked plenty about our new book, I'll Be Home for Christmas Movies, available now wherever books are sold. You should subscribe to this program if you've not already on Apple Podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review. We'll read it on the air. You can also leave us stars or thumbs or whatever positive feedback they've got at the various places that we stream, including Spotify, Stitcher Radio, Google Play, Amazon Music, TheLounge.com, CastBox, Podbean, you name it. A whole bunch of places. Thank you, Blue, as always, for our wonderful theme music. Go check out his brand new album, Six Tape, at his website, blueBLEU.bandcamp.com. And follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. We'll be back next time with more, but until then.
Oh, yeah, I'm supposed to say goodbye.
Yeah.
I'm just, listen, this news came like 5 minutes ago, and now I'm just in a whole other
world.
You're
in the glow. Just say goodbye, and we can get on with our lives.
Goodbye.